I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The current Senate Minority Whip of Kansas made her mark in state politics as a staunch supporter of education funding and as a leading figure in rolling back Sam Brownback's signature tax cuts. Now she's running for governor. Today we'll ask Democrat Laura Kelly about her bipartisan work in the past, and we'll hear her plans to put Kansas on a path to fiscal recovery. Then, if you're looking for proven ways to reduce unemployment and increase earnings, test scores, and even longevity, a better set of fair housing laws could do the trick. We'll find out how residential integration could help end generations of racial inequality. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In some circles, Kansas State Senator Laura Kelly is regarded as a frontrunner for the Democratic nomination for governor. One reason, she has the backing of former Governor Kathleen Sebelius, who's a friend. But she still faces stiff competition for the nomination from two other Democrats. They are Josh Swatty and Carl Brewer. With the primary election just 43 days off, it's safe to say the race is beginning to heat up. Senator Laura Kelly joins me here in the studio, and so nice to have you. Welcome.
So great to be here, Steve.
You didn't hop into this race right out of the gate, Senator. In fact, the word was you had to be talked into this. Was being governor something you had aspired to for a long time?
It was not on my bucket list, Steve, no. I've been asked to run for governor for years, actually. It wasn't until December that I decided that I needed to get into the race.
What changed your mind?
Well, I honestly looked at what was on our slate, and I felt that I was really the only person, because of my experience and the relationships that I have and the understanding of our state and the problems that we're facing, that I was the only person who could run a campaign robust enough to defeat Kris Kobach.
Was Governor Sebelius an influencer in what you were trying to sort out there?
Governor Sebelius has been a great supporter of mine for years. And certainly has been a great assist to this campaign.
Weren't you guys at one point in your lives early morning walking partners or something around Topeka?
Yeah, Kathleen's a very early morning person, so I went ahead and walked with her around the neighborhood. She used to live right next door to me.
Let's turn to the state of Kansas and what kind of condition it's in today. A lot of people think Kansas faces a huge mess. What's your view?
Well, I've lived through the mess being created over the last 8 years. There's no doubt that the tax cuts of 2012 and 2013 absolutely devastated our state. It's dismantled our schools, damaged our roads, our entire, actually, I think the very fabric of our community. So, yeah, we're in a world of hurt.
Do you think Kansans get it? Do they understand the challenges facing the state going forward?
You know, I don't think they understood that so much in 2014. I think that's why they reelected Governor Sam Brownback. But I think by 2016, we could see that they got it. You just look at the elections for the House and the Senate in 2016. 13 new Democrats in the House, a rash of new moderates in the House and in the Senate. A new Democrat in the Senate. So, yeah, they got it. These folks all ran on fixing the broken Brownback experiment and funding our schools.
Why do you think Governor Brownback signed those tax cuts, Senator? I mean, he was warned, he was cautioned not to do it. A lot of people knew they were too big for the state to swallow a hole like that. What's your sense?
You know, Steve, I lived through that moment, and it was just absolutely surreal. I never thought he would do it because it was very, very clear what it was going to do to the state, and the damage was going to be deep and fast. I have no idea what he was thinking. I can't believe that he doesn't like the state of Kansas that much that he would have signed it. He might have actually really believed in trickle-down economics that we know don't work. That's all I can think of. And as the years went by and it was clear what was happening to our state, he stuck to his guns through it all.
State Senator Laura Kelly is my guest. She's a candidate for the Democratic nomination for Kansas governor. You know, as we're talking here, there are obviously a lot of needs out there. The state highway fund has been robbed of hundreds of millions of dollars. Welfare programs are hurting. The state prison system is hurting. Is there enough money coming in to get Kansas through another 4 years without a tax increase?
Well, you know, Steve, we were able to overturn the Brownback tax experiment last year and put ourselves back on the road to recovery. We really need to let the dust settle on it. We're not sure of the actual impact of what we did on a state level and then the impact of what's been done on a federal level. So I think we need to give it some time and take a look at it mid-year next year and see where we are. I do know the one thing that we need to do, though, in terms of taxes, is to work towards a balanced tax structure like we used to have under the leadership of Governor Bill Graves.
Property, sales, and income, right?
You know, the old three-legged stool.
Right.
A third property, a third income, a third sales.
You know, one of the big issues out there, maybe the biggest, I know you're asked this all the time, is the funding of schools. I just said in the newscast that the state Supreme Court is about to announce its big decision in the Gannon case at 3 o'clock today. The legislature added $525 million over 5 years to fund the schools. What's your sense as we sit here today, just hours before this ruling comes out? Is that going to be enough to satisfy the court?
Well, Steve, you can't forget that last year we also put about $300 million into schools. So you add that to the $535 that we put in this year. And then there's some other funding that we increased that will directly impact our K-12 system. You know, funding for social workers and psychologists to actually be placed in the schools. And then we did restore funding for early childhood education. So I'm cautiously optimistic that the Supreme Court will see this as a good faith effort. I don't think they'll give up jurisdiction on this case like they did with Montoy in 2005. I think they'll hold our feet to the fire this time. And that's the right thing to do.
You know, given the late timing of this ruling, the fiscal year ends later this week, if I understand correctly. The legislature couldn't come back into special session this week. It's too late to deal with a decision from the court today to boost funding even further. So given those parameters, what would be a likely path forward here?
Well, like I said, I'm hoping that the court will rule that what we've done is okay. If they don't, you know, we will need to come back and we will need to infuse more funding into the system. I think right now, given the balances that we've been showing every month above our estimates, that we can find those resources if we absolutely have to.
So it's possible the court could say, hey, you've got to spend more money and you've got to get it done by July 31st legislature would have to come back during the month of July. Is that a potential?
You know, I think there are a variety of scenarios that could happen because in reality, they could let us go until next session and do it then, since we'd only be halfway through the fiscal year, and then we could, you know, so we could infuse funding for the second half of the school year.
You know, tell us a little bit more about yourself, Senator. You grew up in a career military family household. I gather that means you moved a lot.
Oh, we did move a lot, Steve.
You know about that, eh?
By the time I was six, I'd actually lived on three continents. And by the time I was 15, I think I'd moved 12 or more times and gone to I don't know how many schools. So
that's tough on a kid.
You know, actually, I sort of enjoyed it. I enjoyed the variety and the cultural differences and all those kinds of things. But when it came time, and my husband and I had our first child, we really did want to establish some deep roots, and that's why we chose to come to Kansas. Great schools and this deep sense of community one feels here.
I was going to say how long you've been here.
32 years.
32 years. Mm-hmm. Before you went to the state Senate, you were the longtime head of the Kansas Recreation and Park Association. What did you do there?
You know, that was a great job. I got to travel all over the state of Kansas working with our communities to really make them better places for our kids and families through their parks and recreation departments.
Prior to that, you worked in the mental health field. What did you do there?
I did. Actually, my training was in recreation therapy. And so my first job was in a state psychiatric facility for children with severe mental health issues. And then I moved on to National Jewish Hospital in Denver, where I worked with kids who had respiratory disease as their primary problem, but secondary mental health issues. So I spent a good 12, 15 years working in that world.
What do you make of the state of the Kansas mental health system?
It's a wreck. You know, that's another thing that has been dismantled over the last 8 years. It's my plan when I become governor to really convene the stakeholders in that world and put together a really comprehensive plan that looks at our mental health system from prevention, you know, through institutionalization and discharge, and find out where the gaps are and then work towards filling those gaps.
You get a sense that the mental health problem in Kansas and everywhere is far more severe than most of us realize.
I think all we need to do is look at the spike in the suicide rate recently to understand that we have some very serious mental health issues here in Kansas and across the nation.
You know, you went to the state Senate in 2004. Why did you want to go into politics? Where did you go wrong, Senator? You seem like a nice person. What happened?
You know, I actually I didn't aspire to be a politician. But at that time in 2004, I was watching my current state senator, the incumbent, voting against school funding. And that was enough to flip the switch. I said, I can't tolerate that. I really need to get into that race and defeat him and start representing Kansans the way I thought they needed to be represented.
I was going to say, you walked into a state Senate that had been led by Republicans forever. You were in the minority. Why agree to take on and absorb that kind of punishment? Because it's hard being in the minority. You don't have as much power, obviously, as you would if you were in the majority.
Well, it's a different sort of power, you know, and I think I recognized, I mean, I was a math major when I went into college, so I can count. And I knew at any given time I've been in the Senate, the most Democrats we've had have been 10. It takes 21 to pass a bill. So I immediately went across the aisle and worked to develop close relationships with the moderate Republicans. And it worked. You know, we worked very closely together on a lot of good public policy.
What are you proudest of from your work in the state Senate?
Oh, probably the relationships that I've formed. But I think in terms of a very specific thing, it's been what I've been able to do to enhance our early childhood education offerings.
You talk about holding the Department of Children and Families accountable for its lack of transparency in recent years, which has affected the safety of kids in the state foster care system. What did you do exactly there?
Well, you know, when I learned, as many others did, about the missing kids, the kids sleeping in offices, the kids dying in our system, I really did sound a loud alarm and demanded that agency provide us accountability and transparency. I think as a result, you know, the former Secretary of Department of Children and Families resigned, and we've created that task force now that's total role is to determine where the problems are and what we can do to solve them. And that will be high on my radar screen when I become governor.
There's a new leader of the Department of Children and Families, Gina Meyer-Hummel. She's been here. Has the department turned the page or is the jury still out?
I think the department is making some progress on some issues. I think that Secretary Meyer-Hummel has the best interests of the kids at heart. I'm disappointed that she supported the adoption discrimination bill. I don't think that was a good idea. And I don't think it's a good idea to be hiring people who are not licensed and trained in the field of social work to fill some of the roles that she's doing. So we will look at it differently when I get in.
Laura Kelly is my guest. She's a candidate for the Democratic nomination for Kansas governor. Let's turn to guns, Senator, because that's been an issue that has caused some Democrats some consternation when it comes to your stance over the years. You've been a longtime backer of the rights of gun owners, so much so that you had the support of the NRA, at least for a while. Why the support for gun owners?
Well, I believe that Kansans have a right to own guns. Law-abiding Kansans have a right to own guns and to hunt. So I support the Second Amendment rights. I think, though, I also recognize that we need some common sense gun safety policies put in place. And so I've voted to ban guns now twice on our college campuses.
In fact, that cost you the backing of the NRA when you did that.
And that was perfectly fine. They gave me money once in my 2008 race, about $500, and I just donated that to Moms Demand Action. Because we really do need to put some common sense back into our gun policies. And as governor, I will bring together law enforcement, mental health, public health, educators, and we will together will craft a comprehensive gun sense policy for the state of Kansas.
What would you give us a sense of where you'd like to go? Because what you're saying is that's your focus, not expanding the rights of gun owners, if I'm hearing you correctly today.
I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue really is putting in some safeguards.
Like what?
Oh, I think 3-day waiting periods. I think universal background checks. I think banning bump stocks, assault rifles, no guns on college campuses. I do not believe that we should be arming our teachers. I want them to teach.
You know, one of the big concerns is that there's so many handguns out there that some experts say you can legislate this thing right and left, and at the end of the day, it's not going to make that much difference because there's so many guns out there.
Well,
what do you do about that?
Yeah. Well, I do think that there are laws that we can pass that will keep guns out of the hands of people who should not have them. You know, we just passed a bill that will keep them out of the hands of folks who have been convicted of domestic abuse charges. I think we need to pass the red flag law, which would allow law enforcement to temporarily take away guns from those known to be a danger to self and others. There are things that we can do.
Again, Laura Kelly is my guest. What do you want to do about restoring funding to the highway program, which I've mentioned here this morning, has seen hundreds of millions of dollars siphoned away for road maintenance to fund, cover the cost of Governor Brownback's tax cuts? What should happen there?
Well, actually, Steve, the number is closer to $2 billion that we have swept from the highway fund over the years. We did put together a transportation task force this past session, and they are meeting, and they're folks from the world of transportation, road, aviation, others. And what we've tasked them to do is to figure out what the needs are, to really essentially put together another comprehensive transportation plan, and then to find some dedicated funding sources that we can use on an ongoing basis to fund some of those projects that have been put off.
$2 billion is a lot of money.
It's a whole lot of money, and we've seen the effects of it. You know, we don't have our four-lane highway that we have been promising Southeast Kansas for years. We are now touching our roads every 50 years versus 9 years before, so our maintenance is behind. We've bonded to do maintenance. It's crazy. And
when you say we bonded, you mean we've borrowed money that mm-hmm. we're paying interest on to do basic road maintenance.
To do basic road maintenance. And, there are certain things that make Kansas an attractive place to live and keep our economy robust. And clearly, it's our good schools, and we need to be funding our schools. But our roads and our infrastructure, whether we're talking, transportation or we're talking digital infrastructure, we need to invest in those kinds of things if we are ever going to see Kansas grow again.
You know, just a few weeks ago, Kris Kobach, the Republican candidate for governor, was here in the Johnson County area riding in the back of a Jeep with a replica machine gun in the back of the Jeep as he went through a parade in Shawnee. What did you make of that?
Well, it's not something I would have ever considered doing. I think that Kris Kobach understands who his base is, and I think he's appealing to them. He certainly wasn't appealing to mom and dad and the kids on the curb. So I think that's what he's doing. I think he's playing over the crowd to his base has some reason to think that that will be an effective strategy in a Republican primary.
Just going back to highways for a second, Senator, do you see a need to increase the gasoline tax at some point to make up for all the money that has been siphoned away from the highway fund, or Where are you?
Well, we would have to raise the gasoline tax so high that it's unpalatable. We could not do that make up for what's been taken away. I think I'd like to let the Transportation Task Force, gather data, really figure out what would be a reasonable and effective way to fund our highways on an ongoing basis.
Okay, that's State Senator Laura Kelly. She's a Democratic candidate for the nomination for Kansas governor. Thanks very much for coming in. Appreciate it, Senator.
My pleasure, Steve.
Coming up, the single best way to achieve racial equality in this country. We'll fill you in just a few minutes. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the show, we talked with former Kansas Senator Jim Barnett about why, after more than a decade, he's decided to run for governor again. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we'll hear from one immigrant to Kansas City about what it's like being in a long-term immigration detention center. Our guest spent months detained while her child in Texas and Pennsylvania during the Obama administration. Well, for years, the debate has raged. What's the best way to reduce racial inequality in this country? Jobs, fighting crime, transportation? Richard Sander thinks he has the answer, reducing residential segregation. It turns out that if a city can do that, African-American employment rates, earnings, test scores, and even life expectancy all improve, and not just by a little, as residential integration increases. Richard Sander is out with a new book that focuses on all this. He's the co-author of Moving Toward Integration, The Past and Future of Fair Housing. Richard Sander is an economist and a professor of law at UCLA. He joins us from the studios of NPR West. Professor, what a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
Well, how powerful an idea is this notion that residential integration is the key to reducing racial inequality and that you can actually prove it?
Yeah, I think it's very powerful. You know, we've done an awful lot in the last 50 years to try to improve racial conditions in the United States. And that's had a big impact on, you know, many things like the Obama presidency and the entertainment world and the sport world. But there are so many areas where the black-white gap remains very stubborn and very large. Median incomes of blacks relative to whites really haven't gone up in the last 50 years. So the one thing that we see that really does bring about fundamental change is when there's housing integration at a metropolitan level. And the reason that's become a powerful idea is that it really started to appear in metropolitan areas in the late 70s and 80s and early 90s. And then it took a while for that to have the effects that are so important. And then it took a longer while for social scientists to demonstrate it. So it's really only in the last 5 or 6 years that this has become well established.
So in theory, then, this can guide policymakers and mayors and city councils all over the country. In theory, it's a path forward.
That's right. What's interesting is that after fair housing laws were passed in the late 60s, some urban areas just had the right chemistry to make integration happen. In other words, the combination of lower discrimination and other conditions brought about broader housing integration. Other cities don't have the right chemistry, but we now know enough about the cities where it happened to be able to translate that into policy ideas that we can apply elsewhere.
These are cities like where, Professor?
Well, so good examples are San Diego, Seattle, San Antonio. Those are all pretty large metropolitan areas that have had pretty dramatic declines in segregation.
How much impact on reducing racial inequality does this integration, residential integration, actually have? What have you seen out there?
Well, for example, if we look at black-white unemployment, the ratio of black unemployment to white unemployment has been very stable, around 2-to-1 for 60 years. But it turns out that in the last 20 or 30, it's diverged. So there are some cities where it's increased, some cities where black unemployment is triple white unemployment. And then you have the high integration cities where the gap is like 20 or 30%. So we're talking about a six-fold difference in the black-white employment gap in integrated versus highly segregated cities. In death rates, you mentioned life expectancy. Mm-hmm. So the white-black gap in death rates is two-thirds smaller in the high integration cities than in the high segregation cities. So, you know, it's about as dramatic as could be.
I guess an obvious question then here is why? You know, why does residential integration have such a powerful effect on reducing racial inequality?
That is the $64 question, and I don't think, you know, I don't think we know yet. We have ideas, but the problem is that the things we're talking about are so interrelated that it's very hard to sort out one from the other. Now, the reason why we're pretty sure that segregation is a driving force is that segregation happened in the 70s and 80s, and the places where it happened, like San Diego, you know, San Diego actually had a bigger black-white income gap in 1970 than Chicago or New York or a lot of the places that are still very segregated. You started seeing convergence in the 80s and then sort of that building and reinforcing itself in the 90s and the 21st century. So there's a pretty clear kind of time sequence between the general pattern of desegregation and then these improvements in black outcomes. So at that broad level, you can say there's a causal relationship. There are also fancier things that social scientists do that have kind of confirmed this.
Yeah.
And there's one big controlled experiment called Moving to Opportunity, where people were randomly assigned into housing assistance programs and some put in integrated neighborhoods. And that turned out to have a very big impact on kids when they grew up, but it took a long time to observe that. So when we're talking about more specific causal mechanisms, what exactly is happening, I think it's going to take a while to tease that out. But some of the leading candidates, some of the ideas are that, one, blacks are much closer to jobs when they're in integrated areas. Hmm. There's something called the spatial mismatch hypothesis, where in the 70s and 80s, a lot of jobs left old manufacturing cities and went out to the suburbs. So when blacks are more integrated, they're closer to these jobs. Another one is just the peer effects of integration, sort of the importance of having role models and having diverse role models. So one of the things that happens when blacks are more integrated is that they're around a lot more people with college educations. And, you know, school integration has been tried for a long time, but school integration has so much more effect when it's in the context of housing integration, because that's when people in school are actually mixing in the classroom. Their friends outside of school, their parents know each other. And so this sort of multidimensional interaction really, I think, has a much more powerful effect.
Yeah.
And so we see in these urban areas, we see a convergence of test scores between blacks and whites.
This notion, Richard, that residential integration plays such a powerful role here in terms of improving the plight of African Americans, did that surprise you? Did you set off in your research suspecting that this was the case?
I hoped it would be the case. There was a period of pessimism in the 90s. This experiment I mentioned, the Moving to Opportunity experiment, mm-hmm. Was one of the few sort of federally funded experiments we've seen in social research. And the initial results of it weren't that encouraging. They found that, for example, some African-American teenagers, when they made these moves, actually felt more disconnected, and their high school graduation rates weren't going up and things like that. So I would say that a lot of people 20 years ago were fairly skeptical about the idea that there were these powerful effects. But in that experiment, it turned out that to get those really big effects, the really large effects you observed with kids who move like when they're 8 years old or younger, and then they sort of are not leaving an established social network and creating a new one. So some of these effects take a while to transpire, and I've been optimistic for a while, but I would say that social scientists haven't really come around to this view until the last decade.
I'm visiting with Richard Sander. He's the co-author of a new book, Moving Toward Integration, The Past and Future of Fair Housing. We're talking about maybe the best way to achieve racial equality in this country, and that's this idea of residential integration. So maybe another big question here is, how do you achieve it, Richard? How do you move our society toward a more integrated set of living patterns in our urban cores and our cities across the country?
Mm-hmm. So just to make this more concrete, the key thing that we're talking about here is what we call the black-white index of dissimilarity, which is 100 if you have complete apartheid and 0 if you have complete integration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most ethnic groups in the United States are somewhat self-segregated. If you look at Italian Americans or Jewish Americans or Chinese Americans, they have indices that are, say, in the 30s to low 40s. African Americans in the 60s had an index that averaged about 92 across cities. Mm-hmm. So really intense. And this is why the African-American problem, I think, is so unique and so intransigent. Now the average has fallen to about 70, in the low 70s. But this, you have this divergence that I talked about. So there are areas where it's in the 50s to low 60s. Those are the areas where we've really seen these dramatic benefits. And there are areas where it's still in the 80s. So the goal is to get the index down about 20 points.
Mm-hmm.
Once you do that, then this process of integration clearly becomes self-sustaining and you start seeing these big benefits. So how do you get the index down 20 points?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One good example, pretty interesting example, is a program that exists in Chicago. There's a village called Oak Park on the western border of Chicago's west side that instituted a housing mobility program in the early 1970s. This was a time when many areas of Chicago were experiencing a lot of black in-migration that was usually leading to resegregation. And maybe we'll talk a little later about sort of how you can have black mobility and still not have integration.
Mm-hmm.
But in Oak Park, they said, we want to make sure resegregation doesn't happen here. So they set up this center that essentially became a publicly funded housing agency, real estate agency, that would go out and find listings, learn about housing in a wide variety of neighborhoods in Oak Park and neighboring towns, and then provide a free service. So if you were African-American and you went into this agency, then you would get a lot of information about different housing opportunities. And it was really deeply layered. In other words, the agency would say, you know, this is a neighborhood that you haven't been in. Why don't we drive you over there? Let's introduce you to a couple of the housing providers that we know. Let's, you know, make this feel as familiar and comfortable as possible. So they really expand people's sense of where it's possible to move. And conversely, for whites who go into the center, they do the same thing, but try to expand their understandings of African-American neighborhood opportunities. And so through this, they really changed the way that the real estate market functioned in that area. Instead of people just sort of going through word of mouth and kind of reinforcing patterns of segregation, people moved into neighborhoods that they learned about and hadn't been familiar with before.
I mean, that strikes me as such amazing foresight for that community to recognize this as early on as it did.
Yeah, it is. And part of what's amazing is that, you know, political administrations would change, but almost every administration for 30 or 40 years was committed to this program. So,
and it worked, apparently.
Oh, yeah. Oak Park and the area right around it is now the most integrated area of Chicago. I mean, and it's an island. It's maybe a couple hundred thousand people in and around there, but it has a integration level comparable to any of these integrated cities I'm talking about.
So you're suggesting that perhaps that could be a path forward for lots of cities, including Kansas City, going forward.
Yeah. You know, if we can scale it up to a metropolitan level, that seems like a great technique. And what's interesting about it is that it's not very expensive, and it's entirely voluntary. And it's making the market work better. In other words, it's something that people across the political spectrum really ought to agree sort of makes sense. You know, there are folks who argue that housing segregation today just reflects people's individual choices.
Mm-hmm.
But a program like this is clearly aimed at expanding choices, right? It's the sort of thing that ought to make markets work more efficiently. So I think it's easy to defend to a free market folk as well as somebody who kind of is passionate about racial justice.
We're talking about maybe the best way to achieve racial equality in this country, that's residential integration. If you want to join our conversation, we'd like to have you. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Does everybody benefit from integration, Richard?
Well, that's a good question. You know, you might think that if African Americans are doing better, then somebody else has to do worse. But here's the thing. It looks like areas that have high levels of immigration have several other things that are good for everyone. One is that crime rates fall. So not only does black crime fall, but it turns out that crime falls even in white neighborhoods in more integrated areas. You have much less racially polarized voting. So, and you tend to get more spending on public services because politics changes from kind of an us versus them mentality to sort of a more civic mentality. I mean, it sounds Pollyannish, but there's actually a couple of very good empirical studies showing this. And, you know, with housing integration widespread, people's housing choices are no longer determined by what racial zone they need to live in to be comfortable. They can live anywhere, and therefore commuting times tend to go down. People tend to be closer to wherever they're working. So all these things make the overall housing market more efficient.
And maybe one concern then might be, though, on the flip side, gentrification?
Well, gentrification has become a really hot-button issue in the fair housing community.
Right, sure.
And I think it's, I think it's understandable, but I really want to push back against it. There's a fair amount of research showing that gentrification usually does not lead to significant displacement. There are a couple of good studies, including one by a Columbia professor named Lance Freeman, who showed that displacement is actually lower in gentrifying areas than in non-gentrifying areas, because a big source of displacement in a typical inner-city community is just the decline of housing. You know, housing becomes abandoned if there's no sort of revitalization going on, and that causes displacement too. So it's often
sword.
Overdrawn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's sort of very visible and therefore very much in people's faces. You can see one fancy building in a neighborhood as a sort of a stark indicator, whereas decline, which is more common, is much more subtle and incremental. But all that said, I think it's really important for folks who want to push integration programs to get in front of gentrification. And one of the big strategies that we argue for is the idea of housing trusts. So suppose you're in a city that has gentrification and you establish a housing trust that's capitalized at, say, $100 million. That trust identifies neighborhoods that are entering the stages of gentrification, mm-hmm. and preemptively buys low and moderate income housing that's in the rental market. While it owns it, it puts in a deed restriction that limits the price increase that particular housing can experience, and then resells it into the private market. So it's not going to sell at a full market price, but the discount's going to be pretty small. And then that housing is essentially insulated from gentrification.
That's interesting.
So you do accomplish two things at once. One is that the neighborhood now has kind of a safety screen to make sure that there's going to be some economic diversity remaining. And secondly, gentrification is going to be more dispersed because that neighborhood can't completely flip, and therefore gentrifiers are going to be looking in other neighborhoods. So it really seems like a win-win, and it's pretty inexpensive on a per-unit basis.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the best way to achieve racial equality in this country. It's residential integration. My guest, Richard Sander, his new book, Moving Toward Integration, The Past and Future of Fair Housing. He's a professor of law at UCLA. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some calls here. And John from Kansas City, Missouri. John, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. Dr. Sander, I'd like to ask you how you scale up housing integration policies when a metropolitan area like Kansas City is so evenly divided between two states in terms of population, and one side has a substantial minority population and the other state has a very low minority population.
Great question. Richard?
That is a great question. Thanks for that. A key to doing all this is to have cooperation across a metropolitan area. And that's difficult, you know, in my area, Los Angeles, we've got like 100 different jurisdictions. So
and we've got to be challenging. Even tougher, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, it can be. So our notion is that we have a in the early stages of this program, if this becomes a generally accepted or embraced idea, is to have something like a race to the top, which we had under the Obama administration with education programs. And the notion is, let's encourage metropolitan areas to form a voluntary council and offer the carrot of some funding, maybe partly private, partly public, but funding to really get a meaningful integration strategy underway. But you're going to have a competition among metropolitan areas and see which ones are actually organized and willing to cooperate enough to do this in a serious way. And thereby, you know, you create an incentive for metropolitan areas, you know, to get additional funding by having this cooperation. And you end up picking ones that actually are going to have the structure in place to do it. We have a lot of different urban areas that need this. So given the reality that there's going to be a limited amount of funding available for integration, at least in pilot phases, this sort of competition seems like a realistic path forward.
I hope that helps, John. Okay, again, our number, 816-235-2888. In this book's introduction, Butchard, you write this: from a policy perspective, what makes this lengthy investigation worthwhile is our conclusion that we can set even our most highly segregated metropolitan areas on a path toward much more moderate levels of black-white segregation and do so more easily than most observers might imagine. How so?
Yeah, so a lot of the people who are very pro-fair housing have, I think, believed that housing discrimination is a really fundamental barrier, and they believe that economic differences are a really fundamental barrier. And what we show in the book is that both of those are much less formidable than is often assumed. So housing discrimination has fallen dramatically. It is still a problem. It's still something that we need to address. We've got some suggestions on ways to improve our fair housing strategies, but discrimination is really much, much better. And on the ground, you see people of different races moving into neighborhoods where they're a minority at much higher rates than in the past. So we have pretty tangible proof that the level of tolerance that you need for long-term sustainable integration really does exist. So that's one important ingredient. On the economic side, you know, I mentioned this index of dissimilarity that goes from 0 to 100. It turns out that only about 25 points of that are accounted for by economic and socio-demographic differences between blacks and whites, like differences in age distribution. Hmm. So that means that we could get segregation levels down into the 30s for African Americans without changing anybody's income. And a lot of fair housing programs right now are, I think the most common fair housing strategy is to build subsidized housing or provide vouchers for low-income African Americans to move into better communities. And that's quite expensive. So knowing that you don't have to include an incomes policy as part of an integration strategy, or at least it doesn't have to be a central part, I think is another really powerful enabler of seeing why this is doable. So the overall takeaway is that it's feasible and it's far less expensive than a lot of other social programs that we currently, you know, have underway.
Who are the people these days who, you know, typically wind up opposing integrated neighborhoods? Who's out there?
I think a lot of neighbors still get worried at the idea of subsidized housing projects being built in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sort of a widespread latent opposition to that. People may not really be thinking about that issue, but if such a housing project is proposed, then you can often quickly mobilize a lot of NIMBY opposition to that. But I think that, you know, the broader idea of housing integration and doing it through voluntary sort of individual moves, taking advantage of market forces and so on, my experience is that that's an idea that has very broad appeal, and that it hasn't been embraced yet because it really hasn't been part of our public dialogue. As in many areas, you know, our conversation about housing segregation and race issues related to it has been pretty polarized. So you get a lot of talk from two extremes, but not a lot of talk about, what are modern paths mm-hmm. forward that can actually solve this problem.
You know, a lot of credit is given in the book to the Black pioneers, and I'm wondering, who are they and what did they do when it came to housing?
So in 1948, Blacks were living in incredibly circumscribed ghettos. They were paying a lot more for housing than their white neighbors were. And you had restrictive covenants in white neighborhoods that kept Blacks from moving into their areas. Shelley against Kramer was decided by the Supreme Court 70 years ago last month, and it was a unanimous decision that said it's unconstitutional for courts to enforce these covenants. And what you saw within weeks was the start of a movement where Black pioneers would move into adjacent white neighborhoods. And that phenomenon later got kind of a bad name as blockbusting, mm-hmm. Because there were real estate speculators who kind of exploited the whole process. But there were tens of thousands of Blacks who sort of made these initial moves. And, you know, it took guts to do that. And that started the process of breaking down existing ghettos and sort of changing them into what we have now, which are in segregated areas, just kind of large Black districts. And then after the Fair Housing Laws were passed in the late 60s, you had a different kind of Black pioneer. And these were folks who moved into white neighborhoods that were not adjacent to existing Black districts, but sort of out in areas that were just miles away.
I've got about 10 seconds here.
And those folks were just sort of key lubricants for the process. Where you had a lot of Black pioneers, that's where you really started having a lot of integration. Hmm.
Again, Richard Sander has been my guest. His new book, Moving Toward Integration, The Past and Future of Fair Housing, he outlines the single best way to achieve racial equality in this country. It has to do with residential integration. Richard, what an interesting conversation. Thanks very much. I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great to be on.
You bet. Thank you. Tomorrow on the show, find out how the media spreads faulty information about medical science. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.